and welcome to our second podcast. Today is Thursday the 4th of October and our sponsor for today is Creed Media Limited. With me today I have got Linda, who you've met previously, and Robert. First of all, Linda, what have you been up to since our last podcast?
I've been doing some work, sending out CVs and emails, and because I am actually in the market for a new job at the moment. I'm hoping to move into public relations from journalism. So that's what I've been doing, in addition to be perfectly honest, rather a lot of gardening and a bit of pickling and bottling. It's that time of the year.
It certainly is, yes. And I can say to everybody, I've been very lucky because I have actually benefited from one of the picklings. A nice little jar has arrived in the kitchen.
It sounds like you're getting pickled.
I know. I've just, for the last few days, the weather has been fantastic on the nursery, and it's been a case of catching up. The colours on the trees are amazing, and at the present moment, everybody wants to plant their trees, so been a little bit busy. So it's been really nice for a change. Robert, would you like to say who you are?
Yes, my name's Robert Pawley, and I'm a publishing consultant. I've been working in the publishing industry for about 30 to 40 years with several large companies, but over the last 20 years as a freelance or self-employed consultant. And I've been advising both small and large companies on the production of their books, mostly mass market illustrated hardbacks going to the American market. Also mass market paperbacks going to the British market. In fact, we did 7 million Catherine Cookson's some years ago, which was a bit of a strain. I didn't realise there were 75 plus Catherine Cookson titles, but there are.
She was prolific.
She certainly was. We also did a similar quantity of Agatha Christie's, so that's a mass market end. And the other end, I'm doing specialist children's books, which often have add-ons, such as we put pink plastic wands on books. We put pink little bags to put your tooth in under your pillow on books. Oh. We put pirate kit on books. So Books Plus is very, very common now in the children's market. But also, British children's books lead the world in children's publishing by far. And they still are very, very strong, even against e-publishing. The book proper has a significant role to play still.
There is something special about sitting with a book and reading to a child, isn't there? And sort of waiting for them, fighting with you to turn the page.
This is absolutely vital, and that's what makes it significant. Although we are now coming across a significant number of printers who are offering e-book as part of their printing services, and these are interactive e-books. They haven't proved hugely popular yet, largely because, well, as Karen was just saying, if you're sitting with a child, you want something physical to get hold of. Mm. It wants to chew the corners, it wants to throw it across the room. Something about pressing a button on an e-book or a hotspot on the screen is not quite the same. But it is there, and it will happen. But I think children's books still have a long life yet. And again, just going back to where we were, so mass market through to children's books, which, and also to individual self-publishing, which is a significant market now.
Can I just ask you, because I'm a total novice on this, what is self-publishing?
Self-publishing, well, it's a catch-all phrase. It means you want to publish your own book by yourself without going through a publisher. Simple as that. And there's various ways of doing it. You can obviously print off 20 copies of your home printer, works very well, but you've still got to bind it up.
Doesn't look very good.
No, exactly, it doesn't look very good. And there are numerous websites which offer self-publishing services where you just pay a fee and they'll print you 500 copies, 250 copies.
So what type of books do people self-publish?
Absolutely anything from the worst possible novel
that won't be accepted by anyone
to their own scrapbook of their family. You know, it can be absolute, and they may only want to do two, maybe 25 copies to distribute around the family, but they want it to look smart. So it can be anything. I have brought along an example which is very, very recent. This is only delivered this week to a a neighbour, effectively, who I met at a party, and she happened to say, well, I'm very unhappy with the book I have been self-publishing. It was a black and white paperback. She was psychotherapist. Thank you. And it's a self-help book to get over difficulties and problems in your own life. And she had used a digital print-on-demand service for a black and white edition of this paperback. And she'd had it quite successfully put through Waterstones and Smiths, and it had done reasonably well, but she was very unhappy with the quality. And I think this is where I come in, and I had a meeting with her after meeting her at the party. We've got a little bit jolly. So I said, yes, I'll come and talk to her about it, and I did. And I looked at it, and it was a very disappointing little book. It was mean, it was printed on rather low-quality paper, and it was black and white, and she just didn't like it. It wasn't giving her product the best presentation it really wanted.
So what did you actually do? I mean, how did you...
So what, I,
what
well,
were the options that you offered her?
Yes, thank you very much. I did, indeed. I do this with most of my clients. I say, what do you want? What do you want your book to look like? And in this case, I brought a whole handful of range of titles along and said, look, do you want it to look like this? Do you want it to look like that? Do you want a hardback? Do you want a softback? Do you want it to be bigger? Do you want it smaller? Do you want it in nice shiny paper or not shiny paper? Do you want to... And you go through all this.
God, Robert, there's a hell of a lot of choices to make.
There are a lot of choices to make. One of the things I always say to anybody who's not quite sure what they want is to go to WH Smith or Waterstones and go and find the book nearest to what you want your eventual book to look like. At the moment, we are only talking books. They're boxes and pamphlets and things, but at the moment, we're just talking books. So I then went through the various options, and she said, well, I want it a little bit bigger than it is. I want it I want it to be colour, not black and white. And immediately, then I'm being pushed down a certain direction, because if you're going to do colour, you have to have a certain quality of paper.
All right.
Now, that does not saying you still can't do it digitally. You still can do it digitally. But as soon as you're into colour, the price regime completely changes. Mm. So we looked at what she had, and I'm not talking about pre-production here, but we're talking about printing the actual book. And she happened to have all the original illustrations in colour, so that was quite convenient. She'd lost all the files, of course, which is very common on these occasions, so we didn't have any of the files we should have.
What do you do then?
We captured it from the book.
What does that mean?
We scanned it in. I did an OCR scan.
What's an OCR scan? No, sorry to keep firing questions.
No, quite right. Any word. Word has a very good OCR, which is optical character recognition. And you can feed a page in onto your desktop scanner and capture that page.
So you captured the images from the original drawings?
Yeah. No, the drawings we had, the text we didn't have.
Oh,
so
right.
We captured the text. So once you captured the text, we then had it in a way which we could manipulate it and change the pages, change the sizes as required. And so having decided what she wanted... and I'm just using this as an example of a very, very recent self-publishing job. I then went and looked at various options, and I said, well, how many do you want to print? And she said, well, how much does it cost? And I said, well, that's unfortunately the chicken and the egg. So let's start. I said, how many do you think you're going to sell over a period of 2 years or whatever you want? So we started at 500 copies, and we went up to 2,500 to 3,000 copies, which, from my experience, is the sort of bracket which anybody doing self-publishing will do.
And that makes a big difference, doesn't it, as to, I mean, the number of books that you're publishing, as to where you might want to end up publishing it.
It's absolutely crucial. It makes every bit of difference, particularly when we're talking about a colour illustrated book. My experience, when I look to place a printing job, we just don't look at Britain, we don't just look at Europe, we don't just look at Eastern Europe, we look at the whole world. With one exception, we don't look at South America and North America because prices are just unbelievably crazy. and shipping costs are just disproportionate. And what's more, the American market is not set up for exporting books. The Chinese market, which is fundamentally based in Hong Kong, but all the print plants are in China, is set up for exporting books, colour illustrated books, and black and white, but mostly colour illustrated, hardback and paperback, for shipping all over the world. It is a specialist market. So is Europe. The UK, unfortunately, for colour illustrated short run, when I say short run, I mean printing runs of less than 5,000, is simply not viable, unless it's a Christmas title where time constraints are absolutely critical.
Would you say it's not viable? You mean financially?
It's not viable financially.
But if you've got a very small print run, say 500, is it cheaper to print it in the UK? Or
absolutely, abroad? And I think I'll use this book as an absolutely typical example. It was, if I remember correctly, 128 pages, which is very typical for a small paperback. It's a little bit bigger than A5, which is
standard novel size.
1x8x210 mils. So, but it's slim, and it also was, in this particular case, had a CD in the back of it, which slightly changes the cost parameters, but not hugely, because the cost of producing a CD in the UK, the cost of producing a CD in China, pretty much the same. Because it's an automated process. There are no humans involved. You put in your master, press a button, and a CD comes out of the end of the machine. So, you know, the advantage of China or Eastern Europe are labour costs. There's no labour in producing a CD, and that's why they're pretty much the same.
So just to fine-tune that, if you're printing 500 books, it's cheaper in the UK, but if you're printing 1,500, it's cheaper to go abroad?
In this case, this is a real exercise done only 6 months ago, so it's an absolute... And I made a point of going to at least two or three printers in the UK, digital printers, and what's known as short-run printers, who are print conventionally, which is LIFO printing, which is what 99% of all books are printed LIFO. But now digital printing, which is just the same as you would use on your own printer in your own office, are beginning to cut in at the bottom end. But back to Linda's point, I did the exercise on 500 copies of a colour, 128-page paperback. It was cheaper in the UK.
That's great to hear.
On 1,000 copies, on 1,000 copies, and I should say that it also included producing the CD.
Right.
And bearing in mind that a CD has a printed cover, so there's a print element to the CD, not just the plastic CD itself, which is identical, as I said, to Forrest, but the printing of the cover, putting the CD into it, into its sleeve, and sticking the CD into the book are labour elements, and they have to be taken into account. So back to the point, 500 GP UK, 1,000, exactly the same price as the Far East, 1,500, considerably cheaper in the Far East. So it's back to my client, how many copies did she want to print? And they opted for 1,500, end result, done in the Far East.
The other difference, I think, which is quite interesting, I mean, just looking at the book, if I can just reach across the table and grab hold of it, is this book is... It's sewn, isn't it?
It is sewn, indeed.
So it's old-fashioned sewing, which means that the book is less likely to fall apart.
It is much less likely to fall apart now.
Because nothing annoys me more, and it happened to me the other day. I picked up a paperback. Well, I was on holiday. Somebody had probably taken it to the beach. It had got a bit soggy, and half the book fell out of my hand.
Mm.
You know, and it's infuriating. Whereas if they're sewn like this, that doesn't happen, does it?
Yes, and that's back to this labour thing. In the UK, you will never find a paperback which has been sewn. And again, because this particular book is colour, we're printing it on a what's known as a silk paper.
Yeah.
Not, it's not full gloss, but it has a shine to it.
Yeah.
The problem of...
Feels nice.
Indeed it does. And it has a good result on the colour. Because a shiny paper, the ink sits on the surface, doesn't soak in like blotting paper, so it stands up proud. Or it looks really strong. The trouble with papers like that, if you glue them, the ink doesn't soak into them in the same way. And they tend to fall apart.
All right.
Now, in the UK, I mean, probably fine, but it is a weakness using a semi-art stock, which is technical speak for shiny paper.
Ask you something, because I mean, you know, Karen just said, oh great, that it's so nice to know that, you know, British printing companies can be competitive. Because do you find that clients come to you and say, I'd really like this to be printed in Britain, or do you find people just go, I want the cheapest?
Interesting enough, I had a job early last year. It was a very prestigious book on five decades of photography in Scotland. It was going to be their lead title, this particular publisher, Lohmann Publishing, Lohmann Books. It is now available. I'm sure anybody's interested, but you can get it from Lohmann Books. And they wanted it printed in, first, Scotland, and secondly, if not Scotland, in Britain. We looked at it, and we looked at it really, really hard. They looked at it even before they came to me, and they couldn't find anything viable on the pricing. It was a big fat book, 256 pages, large format, mass market, jacketed, good coffee table book.
Mm.
We, not to say we, myself and my client, we all looked at it together. I looked at both Singapore, I looked at three printers in China. We were 30 to 35% cheaper than the nearest UK price.
That's a huge margin.
Well, that is normal.
And that's just based on the fact that they have cheap labour, basically.
Not necessarily. They have a much more... We're very, very short. There's only one... There's lots of printers in England, but there's only one printer binder who can bind and print colour illustrated books. And that's it. So, and this is a result, I'm afraid to say, of the 1970s and 80s, when the British printing industry was completely destroyed, I'm afraid to say, by the unions.
Mm.
And it just was absolutely decimated. Everything went abroad, particularly on binding. So if you're looking at printing a magazine, plenty of printers in Britain. No problem at all.
So if you're printing a magazine or company magazine, yep, or a brochure...
Yep, then no problem at all.
You can go local.
You can go local. You can go local. You can go local for very small... There are small printer binders all over the place, but they're expensive. You know, if you don't mind spending the money, it can be done, but they're very small. So if you're going to do 5,000 copies, they're just going to be disproportionately expensive. But people do use them. And that's probably because they don't come to me and get better advice. But, yeah, 35% on a colour-illustrated hardback coffee table book is pretty much the saving you would expect to get in the Far East. And if you went to Germany, it'd probably be 20% saving, and similar if you went to Italy or Spain.
What about India? Because it's got a publishing industry.
Yes.
You never hear much about it.
India actually is very competitive now. The quality, at last, in certain printers, is now up to what we'd expect. For many, many years, it wasn't. It was printed on dreadful paper, and basically the print was awful. But now it is up to good quality. The problem with India is getting the books out of India. They have no control of their export systems. So you can go to the docks, and you can wait 4, 5, 6, 7 weeks before ship leaves. And in publishing, schedule it, everything. And if you can't guarantee that it's going to leave your docks on time and arrive in Britain on time, you can't afford to use India. If you have the luxury of schedule, yes, you can get very good deals.
But scheduling can be a nightmare, can't it? I remember when you were talking about the Catherine Cooksons earlier, and I should probably put my hand up here and say, Robert, he's actually my husband, so I know quite a lot about this. When you were doing the Catherine Cooksons, you had lorries coming from all over the place. Now, you were trying to track them, weren't you, on mobile phones?
Yes.
Talking to people in Polish. He doesn't speak Polish, by the way.
Yes, actually, that wasn't the Catherine Cookson, but it was the same set of printers we used for Catherine Cookson on, which is Bertelsmann. Bertelsmann is the biggest printer in the whole of Europe. They have plants in France, in Germany, and Italy, Slovakia. And we were actually doing, if I remember, Jane Austen of Pride and Prejudice.
Oh.
And we were doing 1.5 million copies of Pride and Prejudice. And we had to bring them in from five different plants all over Europe. And it was an absolute nightmare because none of the drivers spoke English. They all had to arrive in England within a 3-day window because they were being given away with one of the nationals, and I can't remember which it was now, and they all had to arrive at the finishing plant to be put into the plastic bag which went with the national newspaper. And we had something like 10 container loads coming in. Actually, it's a lot more than that, because I think we only got 40,000 books per 40-foot container. So 1.5 million books divided by 40 will tell you how many
containers you had to bring in.
Yeah, exactly.
And they all got lost, and half of them got lost, and half of them ran out of their driving hours and had to stop up the side of the road. And it was just a dreadful, dreadful nightmare.
It did get done, though.
It got done. And scheduling is critical. And this is one of the reasons why people look towards UK and Europe. If you print in Italy, you really have to allow 2 weeks to ship. So your books are finished, you've got to allow 2 weeks before it leave from finishing it in Italy to get into your warehouse. If you print in the UK, you've probably got to allow a week from finishing a book to get into your warehouse. When I say into warehouse, I'm talking logging in, getting onto the system before you can ship your books out, because there's no good having a book which isn't on the computer system in a warehouse. It's completely valueless. But if you do it in the Far East, which is my speciality, we have to allow 5 weeks from the book leaving the plant to into warehouse. And this is what every one of my clients has to understand. While you're getting a 35% plus saving in price, you have to the discipline to make sure all your files are correct, which we haven't even talked about, which is another whole area. Your dummies have been approved, which is the blank version of your book, just for people to look at the paper, the size, the weight, because if you might want it for mail order, you want to know exactly what it weighs. All these things have to be taken into account. There might be prototypes of, we were talking about book add-ons earlier on, which is little bits of plastic for children's books, and there might be, well, I did a plastic sprout once, believe it or not. It was a plastic sprout which had two arms, two legs, two ears, a nose, and I think an umbrella. Oh, and a cocktail glass in its hand, all of which had to be made separately and prototyped and approved and then shipped into Britain for Waterstones before Christmas.
We won't ask you why.
No, please don't ask me why. But we had a year to do it and we still ran out of time.
That is
because of the prototyping of the plastic. So as soon as you get into something which isn't a book, or what generally referred to as a book plus, your schedules are rapidly expanded.
If we write books,
stick to paper, add on. Yeah. Stick to ink on paper, and the sort of turnaround times you might expect, and we're talking about this 128-page paperback, which was printed by a very good company in Hong Kong, they required, from signing off the plotter proofs, which is the last thing you see before it goes to press, and you put your signature on it, and you put a date on it, and that is it. So if you've missed something on that thing called a plotter proof, which is fundamentally a low-grade colour representative of the book. Once you sign that, your book's on press. There's nothing you can do about it. And if there's a mistake in it, it's your fault, basically.
We should maybe, just go back a few stages. Because I know, we won't mention any names here, but I know in the past you've had a lot of problems with clients hitting your deadlines or their own deadlines, actually getting the stuff to the printer, in terms of actually getting all those previous
bits and bobs
done, and then getting very cross because they weren't going to actually hit their schedule when actually it was their fault.
I'm sure it's not unique to the publishing industry.
I can tell you it isn't.
The thing is, let's say you've got a Christmas title. That means it has to be in the UK, basically September. Get into a warehouse, out of a warehouse, into the shops. You create a schedule like anybody else. You say, okay, when do I want the books in? And you work backwards. So you say, it's going to take me 5 weeks to ship. It's going to take me 5 weeks to print it. And you then give your client, I must have the files by. You must turn around these proofs by. And these are the deadlines you give the client. Now, the client usually has a problem because the author's late, or the illustrator's late, or someone's on holiday, or someone's ill.
Or the designer's thrown a hissy fit.
Yes, as happens very often, designers have a habit of throwing hissy fits, so I can tell you that, and storm off, or any one of many of these things which might go wrong, or basically everything's just late anyway. But the publisher, by and large, will always think it can be fixed at the last minute. They have this built-in optimism, no matter what you say, that this is a deadline, this is a brick wall, you cannot go beyond it. They still think it can be done. And sometimes it can, because, being sensible, I was building a little bit of safety, don't tell anybody.
You just told an awful lot of people.
I know, but the little bit of safety is very, very little. And may only be a week. And very often a client will simply not sign off something in time. And if production is taking place in August, which is the busiest time of year in the Far East, and again, we're talking about the Far East, but if we're talking the UK, it would probably be August to September. Everybody wants their Christmas titles produced on time. Everybody's running late, and every single printer is running like a bat out of hell, basically, to get the books done. And it is for clients who pay on the nail, and the clients who don't mess around, who get their books up front ahead of the ones who screw up, basically. Yes. That's how it is.
And of course there are cost implications, because if you're very late, they might not have the paper that they brought in. They might have got used for something else. You know, there are all sorts of implications.
There are huge implications, yes. If they're very, very late, if you're using an unusual paper or an unusual size of paper, they may not be able to get that. Or there are other problems apart from the queue. As I said, it's always a queue. There might be difficulties with licensing, because if you're doing a back to this book plus, if you're doing anything to do with a piece of plastic, or if you're doing a children's board book, which is, you know, the very hard ones for very, very small kids under three, they all have to be lab tested to get a CE certification.
To get a board?
CE, which is the big CE on the back, which says it's been safety tested.
Right.
And that has to, if children's books, any bits of plastic, any toys, all have to be CE tested now.
And what about ISBN numbers? Because if you're self-publishing, you have to go and register one, don't you?
Yes, you do. It's actually quite quick, and if you forget to do it...
We should tell us what it is first.
Okay, it's ISBN, International Standard Book Number, which is unique, and it basically says what country it's from, who's the publisher, what's the price, what's the title, what's the category, fiction, non-fiction, things like that. So it's an abbreviation of what the book is all about. It also goes on to a Nielsen database. Now, Nielsen is a large service company who handle all the ISBNs in Britain and I think many other countries as well. So, you want to publish a book and you want to sell it through a retail outlet. You have to have an ISBN number because they want to scan it at the till. And you can't get an ISBN, you can't get a barcode without an ISBN number, which will then flag up the price as it goes through the scanner.
So how do you get one?
Very simple. You go on to Nielsen database. In fact, you just put an ISBN into Google, it'll come up almost certainly fairly quickly anyway. You download a form and you fill it in and you send it off with some money, of course. It's only about 150 quid, I think. For 10 ISBNs, because that's the minimum you can get. So then you can do 10 books. The ISBN, so, and if you want it very, very quickly, you can get it in 24 hours, you just pay more money. Mm. So it's actually a relatively simple job. Once you've got that ISBN, it's yours. But only the publisher can do it. Back to this book we were talking about earlier, I would have done it for my client if I could. I could not, because it has to be in the hand of the client, it has to be signed for. It has to be their address. You have to have a delivery address. You have to have a publishing address. It doesn't actually matter what it is, but you have to have it. So the client will always have to do their own ISBN number. Once you've got it, all you do is you allocate your title. And if you're doing three or four books, you just write in the title of your book against the ISBN number. and that is it.
Do you need a different ISBN number for every book?
You don't need an ISBN number at all. There's no legal requirement to have it. But if you want your books to sell retail and to have a barcode, yes, they would.
So
have
each
to.
Book would have a unique...
Absolutely, right. A unique ISBN number. But what you then do, once you publish your book, is you then send off a document to Nielsen and say, this is my book, and it goes onto their database. So anybody can go into a bookshop and you can call up, I'm looking for a book on such and such, or I've only got the ISBN, or I've only got the title. They'll be able to marry the two together.
Well, I think that was fascinating. I learned a few things and I've been living with him for years.
So. One of the things that I'm thinking of, some possibly audience that are out there and what they may want to publish. Now, we actually have some friends who have just come back from Base Camp Everest, and they published... yeah, thank God they got back safe. But they published two copies of their photographic journey, which, you know, you wear the white gloves when you sort of read the book. And the cost, I thought, was not unreasonable for having... It is a coffee table book. Yeah. But if I wanted to print a book about, I don't know, how I started the nursery, you know, the stock I sell, that type of thing, I would not be wanting to publish 500.
No.
Because I would never sell them.
Exactly.
I would be looking to possibly print 20. And I can think of people who've got coffee shops who might want to do a small cookery book, you know, that type of thing. Or, you know, other people who possibly have a family company and it's been 3 or 4 generations and want to write the history of the company, that type of thing, where, you know, you're possibly wanting 20, 30, 40 books.
Yes.
How would I do that?
Well, I actually, if we're talking colour here, which I think we are, because, of course, over Everest you want lovely colour pictures, obviously you want to look at your trees in the nursery or whatever it is. Mm. This is an area which is actually not superbly well covered. But obviously, it's digital. You have to do it digitally.
Mm-hmm.
So that's fine. That's not a problem. But the tricky thing about digital printing is the quality of the paper. Well, you have a limited range of papers which you can use, because the companies doing it only offer a limited range of papers because they're not going to... They don't want to...
Buy in, yeah.
Buy in quantity. So the other thing is... is the binding, and we did touch on the binding difficulties earlier. So we're almost going back to that Victorian technique, you know, when you bought your Dickens, you bought it in 16 or 32 page sections,
mm-hmm.
and when you collected it all, you took it down to your local bindery, who put it on a desk and sewed it together and did it hand binding, and that's where we're at still with binding. You can do a paperback binding, which is for short run digital work, but again, we touched on this earlier with the difficulties of types of paper and types of glues, because they won't be sewing it. And anybody who buys out of print books from Amazon will have experienced digital printing with paperback binding. There's a standard Amazon format which comes, which you can tell, you pick it up, you know it's a digital printed one off. And they're fine, but they tend to be a bit stiff, a bit clunky, and not really suitable for what you're talking about. Short-run, smart, possibly case, but does not necessarily. A coffee table book, but only 20 of them.
Mm.
And so there is a little bit of a gap here, and it is expensive. It is binding, which costs money, not printing.
Right. I know that the copy of theirs, I think they paid about £150 each.
Yeah, well, that certainly sounds in the right area.
Does it?
Because if you think how much it costs you to run off the actual printed pages, and I don't know how many pages it was, about 256 pages or something like that, and 256 pages is about an inch thick.
Mm-hmm.
That, what's it going to cost? Probably £25 or probably less if you did it on your own desktop printer.
Mm.
And let's assume you have a good quality one with good quality inks which are properly registered to all the colours.
Mm, which the Pantones.
Yeah, exactly, getting the Pantones right. Problem comes in the binding.
Right.
I often have, when we're doing presentations, we have quite often have to actually make a dummy of the book. And if I don't have time to get my printer to do it, which is the best thing to do, because when you're getting the correct paper, correct binding, correct weight, correct everything, I will go to a very little, excellent little company in Essex and get them to do it. And I can pick up a phone and say, look, I want 256 pages, I want 100 GSM, matte art, I want a 3mm board to it, I want it jacketed, I want head and tail bands, and I want four of them. And he'll say, OK, well, it'll be 40 quid each. So it's in the right, it's in that sort of area, and that's just blank.
So when we all go to that supermarket that we shan't name, but I'm very pleased to say the profits went down today in their announcement, and we see mass market, particularly on the run-up to Christmas, the cookery books.
Yeah, the Jamie Olivers and
yeah,
the,
all that.
And Nigella's and...
Instead of being £25 a book, they are £10 a book. Yeah. What would be the publication costs of one of those books on that?
Well, I haven't seen Jamie Oliver 15-Minute Cooking, but I would guess it's pretty similar to his previous books.
Yeah.
And they're probably doing, I don't know, something like 100,000 copies of that. I think it probably costs about £1, £1.25.
So when you get into mass market, there is quite a lot of profit there, isn't there?
And he'll be getting probably 10%, 12%. Royalty.
Right. Now, I remember...
That's off, his, off the retail. But we don't know what his contract says on discounted books, so...
Yeah. And it sounds like a lot of money, but, you know, you think how many people are taking a cut out of that.
Well, I remember when there was a fixed price.
Yeah.
You couldn't sell books cheaper.
You're selling at 10, but the book's costing £1.25. A physical printing cost. That's the physical printing cost. So then you've got the rest of it to spread around.
Yeah, because it used to be... a good small business to have was a, you know, a bookshop shop, because it didn't matter where you went, you got the price was the same. So you went to your local bookshop because you knew the people, the standard, the quality. Has that meant that more books are actually being published because of the fact that it can go anywhere, or has it meant that we haven't got that full choice that we used to have?
I think we don't have the choice because bookshops, the independents have obviously vanished largely because of Amazon and because of the loss of a net book agreement, which was nearly 35 years ago, I think.
When How many years?
About 30-odd years ago.
Good grief, it shows my age.
When the net book agreement was abolished, which was, if you remember the expression, resale price maintenance. And that certainly damaged the independents dramatically. But independents in small towns survived for a very, very long time. But only when the supermarket started coming into play, when they really got damaged, because they were putting out the mass market books, all the big Christmas titles, as loss leaders, just to pull people in, pull the punters in. So lots of independents won't even bother to sell the Nigella Dawson or the Jamie Oliver now.
Because that's sad. Point. That is really sad, but it's an indication, like quite a lot of small businesses, isn't it? That the big supermarkets take away that market.
Yeah. Well, that and the internet. Internet shopping.
The one thing about Amazon has been a significant advantage to certain publishers, which is unusual. People aren't expecting it, but yeah, this is the backlist. Now, the backlist is books you published last year. But are not in your this year's catalogue right up front. They're in little type at the back because you've still got them in your warehouse. The thing about Amazon is it doesn't make any difference whether it's a front list title or a back list title. It's just a book. So it's like a flat plane. It's like catalogue is even right across. So there's no back list or front list. It's just a book. So if you go and say, I want a book on Betulas or something... up will come a whole plethora of books on bachelors, and they might be someone's old backlist, or it might be the brand new book by, I don't know, Matthew Biggs, or he's not a tree man, is he? But you know what I mean.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
So that has really helped a lot of small publishers.
Oh, right, that's interesting. So there has actually been some benefit.
Some benefit, yes.
Well, that's nice to hear. Well, I think... Thank you very much, Robert,
You're
for
welcome.
Coming in and telling us. I don't know about anybody else, but I found that absolutely fascinating. you're lucky you live with this man, so you get all these books.
In many different ways, yes. Yeah. Well, I don't know, some of them you wouldn't particularly want to bring.
Most of our books are still in boxes because we haven't unpacked them yet.
No, we haven't got any bookshelves at the moment. Yeah. We should perhaps give Robert the chance to give his contact details.
Yes, I was just going to say, if anybody wants to publish themselves and they need a specialist like yourself, yes, how do they contact you?
The best is go to my email address. My company name is Portell Production, that's PORTELL Production, and my email address is Portell at Dial, DIAL, dot Pipex, PIPEX, dot com. Portell at Dial, dot Pipex, dot com.
Okay, we will put that up on the website for anybody who didn't have a pen and paper handy. And thank you very much for
coming in.
I will say that the floor here is strewn, and I'm going to have a good look through.
Or maybe put a few photos of some of the books and things on the website.
We certainly will. Yeah, very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Linda, any topical tips for this week for anybody? What they should be doing with regards to getting their message out there?
Well, as Robert was saying, the lead-in time for Christmas in books is obviously a bit late now, but if you're doing advertisements or anything like that, you want to get something in the parish magazine or, you know, wherever, or leafleting, it's time to start thinking about it, I think. So get those ads in.
All right. My topical tip, I'll give you one off the nursery. So this is trees. I was very lucky to be at a conference with Dr. Glyn Percival from Reading University. Give your trees a little treat. Off their research, it has come out that if you put 40 grams of normal household sugar with 1 litre of water and dissolve it, and then put that over 1 square metre around your tree, you will be feeding your tree and giving it a good root burst to get you through the winter. That's mine. Well, thank you very much. For all the information on today's show, go to the website, which is chatbiz.org.
Thanks for listening.
Lovely. Thank you.